Hey, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whenever you're listening to this. It's Andrew Horowitz, the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and today we got some great stuff. We really do. We're going to be talking with Trader Mike, who is a day trader, a former swing trader, great guy who is a great reference for you on all things about trading. He can be reached at TraderMike.net. And we're also going to be talking about technology, everybody's favorite, with Eric Savitz from Barron's. He is the technical trader from Barron's, and we're going to get right into this in a moment. Stick around, because I'm telling you, today is a good one. We got a lot to talk about and some great guests on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
And welcome to an edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're here today talking about trading, actually, because trading is a big component of investing. In fact, I will tell you that there are so many people that I know that do investing, but they don't understand the dynamic of trading. And the problem with that is they don't know when to get in and they don't know when to get out. They just sort of know when to hopefully buy something in general. And oftentimes you're going to be on the wrong side of the trade. So with me today is a blogger, a fellow trader. His name is Mike Sendeza. Did I say that right, Mike?
Sendeza.
Okay. He's with Trader Mike, a great website, a great resource that you can use. And that is at TraderMike.net, who enjoys an incredibly large following. So what I thought we would talk about and start off this whole concept of trading, because, you know, Mike, one of the things that has always really concerned me is that in the school of investing, there has been taught this idea that day trading or even swing trading or even quick trading of any sort is really bad. And I don't really think that's the case. And I don't think you do either.
No, I definitely don't think that. I've been strictly day trading for about the last 2 years now. Used to be a swing trader and switched to day trading because I wanted to be able to control my risk.
And there is, that's the big thing, right? I mean, when you think about it, the whole idea of controlling risk is all about making sure that you don't really lose too much money. That's the fact. I mean, and when you deal with, I guess the differential is when you're dealing with buying and holding, anything can happen at any time. And there's a difference with day trading, right? I mean, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. A lot of times when I used to hold stocks overnight, I would get caught with gaps. You know, things would gap against me and, you know, just wipe out some nice gains that I had or give me a big loss. And I just like being able to respond to exactly what's going on any given day. It gives me a lot more flexibility. I can go long, go short.
So for those people out there that are thinking about day trading, there's a lot of different ways to do it. Obviously, there's these programs that promise that you're going to get this amazing return by just following a color combination of sorts, if you know what I'm saying. And then there's those that are teaching the real way of investing on a short term and swing trading. What do you do on a daily basis? What's your warm up routine in the mornings?
The mornings, I'm basically just looking at what is active. Typically, those are going to be stocks that are gapping either up or down. So I'm just making watch lists of things that are unusually active.
Right. So if something is, and I'm just picking a number, up 30%, maybe on a news item, maybe on a merger, maybe on an acquisition or something like that, which maybe, I don't know about you, but I look at mergers and acquisitions as something I usually stay away from because they're pretty much priced out already. But
Exactly. I kind of joke that I don't look at the news or care about the fundamentals at all, but I do look at try to find out what's moving the stock.
Right.
So if it's an acquisition, then I don't even want to bother with it.
Right, there's nowhere it can go and not much higher, right? I mean, this is, you know, if it's 36 and it's a 35, what's the difference there? So you take a look at the dailies. You start off probably at 8 or so in the morning on Eastern time and figure out what's going on. How many stocks do you trade in a usual day?
It varies. Probably on average, maybe 3 or 4. I'm not a very active, you know, typically when people think of day traders, they think of people that are scalping for nickels and dimes. But I'm basically trying to buy some things, or I should say buy or short, enter things by noon and try to hold them to the end of the day.
Okay. You know what I find interesting? I call the time period between about 1:30 and about 3 the magic hour. Because oftentimes what I find is that people are getting back from lunch and they may have let things stay for a while. And all of a sudden things start turning around, particularly for a long position at about the 1:30, 2 o'clock time where you see the short covering coming in for the day. We see the movement. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, definitely. And that's part of the reason why I generally don't do much after noon. Things just get real sloppy and dead around that time.
So what can you help people with? I mean, when you're looking at charting, what charting software do you use, or what charting site do you use?
I use a few. For my intraday charts, I just started using Quote Tracker.
You're right.
I use 30-minute bars or candles and just a few indicators. I just have a couple moving averages on there and volume.
And do you find that the one thing is that the day trading process is much more of an understanding of the markets rather than an absolute reference to any particular bar or any particular chart of any sort?
Yeah, definitely.
It's interesting because, you know, only a number of years ago, this really wasn't available when spreads were so wide and they didn't really allow the average person to come into the markets and do this. But with the advent of the secondary markets, the Archipelagos, Instanet, Brut, all these different ones, I mean, it makes it a whole different market for individuals. And there's money for individuals to make in this, right?
Yeah, there's certainly money to be made and to be lost. Make no mistake about that.
Right. So tell me this. This is always what I think people don't understand, and maybe you can help. But in terms of day trading, you know, how do you manage your risk?
Basically, a couple ways. I always enter a stop loss as soon as I get in the stock. Next thing I do is put in the stop loss. That's the primary way. The other way is through position sizing. I want to size my position so that I can only lose a very small amount of my overall portfolio on any one trade.
Okay. So when you put in that sell stop, is it a trailing sell stop or is it just an absolute price? And how do you figure out what that number is?
I usually will trail them by hand.
Okay. Which means you're going to be, in other words, manually. You're going to be watching them and kind of right. Moving up your sell stop. So if the stock's at 30 right now and you may put a $28 sell stop in, if the stock moves to 32, you may move it up a couple of bucks.
Exactly. Like basically what I do is the chart tells me where my stop should go.
Right.
So if I see something, I want to see something that's trending strongly, either up or down. And so let's say I'm looking long. So I find a stock that's trending up and it makes a consolidation. So I'll narrow in on that consolidation and say, okay, how wide or how tall is that consolidation? And I'll generally buy when the stock moves above that consolidation and put my stop below it.
Right.
So that difference will tell me how many shares to buy. Let's say, you know, I'm risking $500 per trade and that consolidation is 50 cents wide. All right, so then I will buy, I can't think now, was that 100 or 1,000 shares?
So then obviously the point is to manage the risk. So let's back it up one more step. When you were first trading, I read a lot about what you did and your history, and I'm going to post that in the show notes for today. But when you were first starting out in the day trading, and actually before that you were really doing more swing trading and investing, when you were thinking about making the switch, what resources did you use to learn how to do it? Was there a particular group that taught you how to do it? You taught yourself? I mean, how'd that work?
When I made the switch from swing trading to day trading?
Yeah. Or from long-term investing to swing trading, either one.
Reading a whole lot of books. That's what initially got me into swing trading. Going from, I pretty much just kind of learned day trading just from the years of, you know, sitting here watching the markets day in and day out. And I actually... There are a couple of blogs that helped me make the switch to day trading.
I think I read the style of the technical analysis you like. I mean, you do all sorts of different charting and all that. But one of the things I was very interested in is that you use some Japanese candlesticks. Isn't that true?
Oh, yes. Have to have my candlesticks.
Well, then you are by far in that elite grouping of people that understand this, because I've even talked to some people in some pretty heavy duty money managers with mutual funds, and they have no clue because there's so many different identities. I mean, you got what? You got the shooting star, and you got the hammers, and you got what are some of the coatings of this?
You know, basically, the strength of candlesticks are that they help you to identify potential reversals. And so what I like right. to use are like a hammer is a real popular one for something that is in a downtrend and is likely to reverse back up. And a shooting mm-hmm. star, like you mentioned, is the opposite of that, something that's in an uptrend and potentially going to reverse back down.
So do you find that, like a shooting star, for example, and I want to blend in this whole idea of behavioral finance, because I think that one of the greatest things that you could do when thinking about day trading is to look at what everybody else is doing. In other words, figure out what the other guy is doing, and then what I mean by that is the market, and then you can invest accordingly. And when you think about the idea of day trading and behavioral finance, if there's a lot of fear going on and you have a candlestick, for example, that is just totally, you know, a stick. I don't know what you'd call this, but a full stick and then just a blob on the bottom. Was that an upside down shooting star or an inverted shooting star? You know, the fact of the matter is that you may have an opportunity for a reversal, because what we're really seeing there is people running probably more so towards the fear side than they should. Usually what happens on without the news to the contrary is that it's going to reverse. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the things that I love about candlesticks, is when I first started trading, you know, I got all these charting packages and all the charts were set to candlesticks. And I was like, what are these? And I switched right. them all to line charts.
Right.
And what was happening was I kept buying tops and trying to short bottom.
Right.
I couldn't
right.
understand why. And then someone turned me on to candlesticks, and I went and read, I think, Steve Neeson's book. And he just showed how these different patterns just tell you the psychology of the crowd. And it's all psychology. It becomes very clear, you know, when power switches between the bulls and bears. By looking at candlesticks.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting because I think that we have a similar idea when it comes to the day trading, because I think that one of the things I recommend all the time, and I think that's very important, is the idea of diversification. Let's just say that for an investor. And I think that one of the things that most people don't do and is very much underrated is the fact you need to diversify your trading styles. Most people think that diversification is just international, domestic, large cap, small cap, healthcare versus technology versus industrials. And I think they forget, and maybe even commodity and real estate, I think they forget the fact that they should probably put in trading styles as well, whether that means long-term, short versus long, or even the time horizon of your trade, because that will help you overall, because there's no one particular trading methodology that works at all times. And am I safe to say that there's been times that you back off and you don't trade because things are not really going in the direction you want them to go? You got to regroup a bit?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I mean, I struggle with that now, because with the type of day trading that I do, when the market is trending really strongly like it has been and has a lot of gaps, it's really hard for me to day trade. But if I was still swing trading, it would just be great. So you definitely have to know how to fit what you're doing to the market.
Yeah, it's a very difficult market. It's interesting because when I look at the market these days, even when a down day today and then it turns back up towards the end, it's kind of concerning to me in the face of the fact that Shanghai was down, I don't know, 8% again today, and you know, some global issues out there. But it seems that we are in a little bit of an exuberant state right now with the markets. And that is a big concern of mine, and I've been struggling with that. But then again, by day trading, the fact of the matter is you rest assured tonight that you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and you can't be hurt, I mean, at least overnight. That's good. I mean, that's good sleep on the pillow at night kind of discussion. You know, you don't have to worry about that. Let's switch over to something. I know that you also follow not only trading in conceptually in the idea of, you know, just the absolute trading, but you're a student of the markets, right?
Yeah, you could say that.
All right. And what's your favorite sector if you were to be an investor, not a trader?
Ooh, it has to be technology.
I think you and I had talked about this surface technology, and when we come back from this, I want to talk to you about that. So, and we're going to try to bring on Eric Savitz now, because I think he's a great guy from Barron's who's going to conference in with us to talk about the whole idea of this new surface technology and maybe look at the differential between that and the iPhone and maybe who's winning that war. So hang on, we'll be right back in 1 second on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
Did you know that you can receive regular updates on finance, stocks, funds, and other investment ideas? Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com/blog and subscribe.
Now, welcome back to the show.
And welcome back. Hey, we are now joined with not only Trader Mike, but also Eric Savitz from Barron's. He is the West Coast editor of Barron's and also has a daily blog that is quite extensively read, as well as writes a tremendous amount on technology. And he also created the Plugged In column for Barron's. So, Eric, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, so I thought what we would do is we left off with this discussion about technology. One of the things that was really exciting was we're seemingly going into a new direction, or at least an expanded direction when it comes to technology. Last week, Microsoft had announced the Surface technology, which a lot of people are talking about it being a coffee table. I think they've missed the point on it, right? I mean, they don't understand that it's really a little bit more than a coffee table.
Right. Well, I mean, the initial use technology is on a form factor that basically is a coffee table. It's a very large screen. Think of taking a big TV and turning it on its side. So instead of looking at the screen, you're sort of looking down on the screen. But what makes it special is that the screen uses this multi-touch and technology that allows you to do things like manipulate photographs or manipulate other things on the screen. In a way that is quite different from the experience you would have sitting in front of a keyboard.
Right, and I guess the best thing people could think about is the Minority Report, which was the movie that had Tom Cruise kind of touching things on a screen, moving things around, and quickly understanding it because it was a much more intuitive interface.
Right, that's right. So demos that they were showing. I saw the technology at this conference last week that the journal had, the technology conference called D. And so one of the demos they were showing involved photographs. So you'd have you'd click on a photo button, and you might you'd have what would look like a pile of snapshots in some corner of the screen, and then you could kind of take the individual pictures, move them around the screen. You could, in a similar way to the way photographs are manipulated on the iPhone, you could make the pictures smaller, you could make them bigger, you could turn them around into a different direction, move them to another part of the screen. And what's kind of neat about it is because you can, it's like a coffee table where you're sitting around on all sides of the display, there's no up or down, so other people can be doing it at the same time. So you can have talk about multi-touch. You can have multiple people doing different things on the screen at the same time, and so you could do it for other things like drawing or other kinds of illustrations, where you might have multiple people working on the same document.
Well, we're clearly in the beginnings of this, but what's interesting is you said something right there, just like the iPhone, you said, because the iPhone is coming out with gesturing and touching and all that. And what I find fascinating, and I'm going to switch over for a second to Mike, is that, Mike, when you see an announcement come out about Apple, I mean, Steve Jobs sneezes, it's up $9, the stock, whereas Microsoft can come out with the most groundbreaking technology in the world, a partnership that will mean billions of dollars of revenue, and the stock goes down $3. I mean, what's the story there?
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple reasons for that. One is, Microsoft is just so big. They've got to do a whole lot to move the needle. So, a few billion in revenue might not be much for them. But for Apple, it's a little different story for them.
Yeah, but they're catching up pretty good. I mean, last week they announced the YouTube integration with the ITV, whatever they call that there now. Just amazing the progression. But what I find fascinating is that, with the Surface technology, while it's a lot bigger, it's still the whole touch technology that they're really bringing to the iPhone. Don't you agree? Anybody?
It's similar technology, but it's doing different things, right? So, it's part of, in Microsoft's case, I don't think you'd find anyone who would say that this Surface technology is likely to be a market for Microsoft that's going to move the needle for them. They're so big, they need to think about multi-billion-dollar businesses, and you know, the initial market for this device is, they're targeting it at casinos and hotels. It might be a nice business, but it's not going to really, for a company where they have several businesses with more than $10 billion in sales,
right?
It's just not big enough to move the needle. And I think in the case of Apple, it's part of the iPhone. It's one of many things that make up the iPhone. For the iPhone, that is a new line of business for Apple for a company that only really has, two. I mean, when Steve Jobs was talking at this conference last week, he was describing Apple as a company that had two existing businesses, one new business and a hobby. And what he was referring to was, the two existing businesses, of course, are music, basically the iPod and iTunes, and the Mac, which, of course, they've had forever. And then the new business is the phone business, the handset business. And the hobby, as he put it, is the Apple TV set-top box, which I think, the implication there was that sales are, kind of growing but not spectacular to date. But it is an early entrance into what would be a new market.
Sure.
To new market for them. But Apple's just smaller. And, they're also, the iPhone is potentially, if it does everything they say, if it sells the way they claim it may, it shakes up the handset business.
Yeah, surely.
I don't think the Surface the desktop computer, the Surface coffee table computer, Microsoft is likely to shake up any other markets in particular. It's kind of a new device. And over time, maybe it'll find its home, but it's not going to change the fortunes of Microsoft
sure.
the way iPhone should for Apple.
Right. Well, absolutely. And what's interesting is coming out probably a little bit less out there, but we don't have to go through this, is the Windows Mobile 6, which is a brand new and pretty advanced and I think a step ahead of Windows Mobile 5, which was the Windows compact version for phones, if you will. That's coming out very shortly. But I did want to kind of move on to another discussion because I'm interested in this. And I think that, this has to do with blogging a bit, which obviously both of you gentlemen are very involved in, publicly talking about everything that you're thinking, essentially. There's podcasts, there's internet radio, which is really big. Where are we going with the technology of satellite, even if XM radio and Sirius, combine and do something? And even looking at the terrestrial radio, because we have this new genre out there where you can easily, through the always-on internet now, have radio and have access to things through the iTunes. I listen to the radio. I listen to indie music and the indie radio pops, independent musics, and a few other things through the iTunes. It's fabulous. I can listen to anything I want at any time, whereas I have to be in a car. I have to be somewhere else if I'm doing the other. So where are we going? What's happening with this whole idea of internet radio, and is it going to destroy the rest of them out there?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on here. So, internet radio has become quite an interesting business, and there are a number of different approaches to internet radio. So, they range from terrestrial radio stations that simply rebroadcast their signal. If you're in the Bay Area, where I am, and you want to listen to KFOG, which is a rock station, you can go to kfog.com or whatever the URL is and listen to it over the web. The same is true for KQED, which is the local PBS radio station. It's called simulcasting. There are lots of examples of that. I like to listen to my college radio station from where I went to school at Penn. So there's lots of that kind of stuff. And then there are a number of startups that have created their own take on internet radio. Pandora is one. There's another one called Last FM that just got bought by CBS for $280 million.
Oh boy.
And so these are kind of do-it-yourself radio stations. So you tell, I'm using quotes there. I mean, you basically specify that you like to listen to, Neil Young, and it creates a radio station for you of artists
right.
or like
right.
Neil Young. So now the difference, of course, between that and the obvious difference between that and satellite radio is, the real market for satellite radio is in the car.
Right.
You can get, stationary devices to listen to satellite radio. But the real market for satellite radio is in the car, which is where people listen to the radio the most, I would say.
Right.
So, you know, XM and Sirius, of course, have are trying to merge. There's a lot of resistance in Washington to the deal, and we'll see whether it gets done or not. I don't think that internet radio particularly threatens XM and Sirius. They have their own issues, but I don't think that's the biggest issue for them. At least if you had ubiquitous internet access on the go in your car, and then some easy way to not crash while you were trying to find internet radio station.
Right.
You know, maybe that would be a threat, but I don't think we're anywhere close to there yet.
But it's a threat to somebody because the legislation to shut down, it's coming soon, to have music radio that is internet-based or internet radio stations that are even nonprofits to shut them down essentially by charging them a needle drop charge, the equivalent of the others. I mean, that is actually going to be extensive for them for a nonprofit. I mean, that's a big problem right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is this issue involving what fees are going, you know, per song fees that are going to be charged to internet radio stations. And, you know, I haven't looked at the issue that closely, but I think it, what it boils down to is some miscalculation about what this was going to do to the internet radio business. So, I mean, I think if you're the music industry and you are struggling for revenue, you're trying to figure out, you know, you're trying to balance competing forces. I don't think you want to kill internet radio because I think, you know, most internet radio is designed in a way where, you know, you can't specify. So, you know, in my Neil Young example, you can say, I like Neil Young or artists like Neil Young. You can't say, please, I'd like to hear After the Gold Rush. So it's not like you're just, downloading your choice. And it is a way to get people to listen to music. There is going to be a formula for the artists and the music industry to get compensated. Most of these services are advertising supported, or they have deals with other ways to sell music. But I don't think it's in anybody's interest to simply kill them off.
Right. Hey, Mike, do you trade these at all? Do you trade Siri or XM at all?
No, I don't.
Yeah. So do you have a rule on that, that like sort of a certain size and a certain share price maybe is out of the range, which would probably disqualify both of these?
Yeah, generally don't trade low price stocks too much. So Sirius would definitely not pop up on my filters.
Right.
Yeah, Sirius is down under $3.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of, unfortunately, it's back to where it used to be. Let me skip over to one more company I want to talk about. Then I want to bring it all the way back, and we'll end on the point of the effect that blogs and podcasts and financial matters like this are having on the markets. But let me ask you, that's a loaded question, obviously, but let me ask you this. Motorola, I've been writing about Motorola for some time, and if anybody was to ask me, like, what one stock would I never want as my core holding, or what one stock is it that I just don't like? And I'd have to answer every single time Motorola. I find that their latest foray, if you want to call it that, into the handset market, obviously, where they had the number one handset. I was in Europe 2 years in a row in the summers, and every single person had a Motorola phone. And I just can't believe they can't turn a profit. This is substantial. You come back, and it's just unbelievable to me they have the whole market. What's the problem with Motorola?
Well, there's a couple things going on with Motorola. So, they had a period of great creativity, with the very thin Razor.
The Razor, Razor, Crazer, Slenders, all those, right?
You know, the Razor was really a huge success for them. And then they've tried to follow up, and they've had some of limited success. I mean, there was great anticipation for the Q, which was their big entrance into the smartphone market. Mm-hmm. But what's kind of happened is that the Razr's gotten somewhat dated. They just did a revision of a new version called the Razr 2.
That was pathetic. That was a Razr like 1.5.
Yeah, well, it's an updated version of the Razr, but it's not it's not dramatically new. And essentially, they've had several things happen. I mean, they've lost, they've been losing share. So they were benefiting for a while from the fact that Nokia was struggling, and Nokia has kind of turned their business around. Nokia, in particular, has really zeroed in on how to make money in the developing world, where you know the fastest growing markets for cell phones are what are some called you know the BRIC countries: Brazil, Russia, India, China. Very high population countries where technology is lesser penetrated than the much more mature markets. And so
that's primarily because they don't have the landline availability, and what they're doing continually is the infrastructure build out, but it's all being based on cell phones and a much higher level cell phone, the G3 or you know than we have here.
Right. And so part of the magic formula there is you have to figure out a way to make cheaper handsets. So Nokia has figured out a way to change their production and manufacturing model to be able to make money selling handsets at a lower average price. And Motorola has not at all been able to do that. Motorola is hemorrhaging market share. They've lost the technology edge at the high end, and they're getting killed by Nokia and others at the low end, and that's left them both suffering financially and losing market share. They're really trying to turn their business around. They've just laid off I think last week they did a
4,000
people were laid off. That's the second round of layoffs they've done in the last few months, and I'm not convinced that they're done yet. I think they're not done.
And the fact is, my wife says to me all the time, she says, you know, you gotta make hay when the sun is shining. And I got to tell you something. They did not make hay. They did not really do anything to capitalize on the Razr, because yes, they made money, things were going well, but the truth of the matter is their stock never really benefited, and that comes down to the fact that nobody was looking out for shareholder value, in my opinion. But whatever. Let's close this up with what's that, Mike?
But I think usability is a big problem for them too, as far as their software and their phones. I know that was a big problem with the Q.
Yeah, Q was a large dud.
Yeah, the other problem with the Q is battery life. So it's a very attractive looking phone, but it doesn't have very long battery life. So compared to say the BlackBerry, for example,
right,
you just don't get as much talk time. And so
you can't have as much talk time. The BlackBerry Pearl lasts about 3 weeks. I've had it for a while.
Right.
Unbelievable.
BlackBerry has done a very good job on power management, and Motorola has not been able to match that. And now, you know, of course, to bring back something else we were talking about before, the interesting question that is going to be an issue for anyone who's in the sort of smartphone end of the business is what does the arrival of the iPhone do to you? Unclear. Certainly if you were if Singular is a primary distributor for your phones and you're selling expensive phones, it would be a worry.
Right, exactly. All right, let's follow up and close on this, because we're all bloggers and now we're talking on this, and there's a lot more availability to find information by people, and there's a lot more people giving the information out. And I kind of worry, and I put myself in the same universe of, you know, information overload, and that where do people find things? What do you think, Mike, is the effect of blogs on the actual individual investor? I mean, you know, how much are they listening? Now they have more than just Cramer to listen to and to find information from. I mean, what is that doing to the markets?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't think there's a whole lot of people that are actually reading blogs compared to, you know, the mainstream media. But I mean, I would hope that people are. I mean, there's some really good stuff out there on blogs, and I would hope that people are, you know, using stuff critically, not just following blindly as to what, you know, they find on some blog, but, you know, getting ideas and then doing their own research.
Right. One of the things I think people have to realize out there is that, you know, make sure that whoever is discussing whatever they're discussing discloses what their holdings are, short, long, or no holding. And obviously you can only hope that that's right. But at the same time, I agree, you know, I think we both agree that there could be a definite bias there.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I'd agree with that too. I mean, I think that you need to just, I mean, I think it's like any publication. You know, you want to know what's the point of view of the person who's writing the blog, and you know, so there are blogs, written by people who are involved in the market. There are blogs written by by people who write for, you know, the mainstream media like I do. And you know, there's the beauty of blogging in some ways is that it's, you know, very low barriers to entry. I mean, you know, there's 70 or 80 or 90 or whatever the number is, million blogs out there. And, you know, it's not that hard to start a blog. You can, yeah. You could, you know, if you started right this second, in 5 minutes, you could have your blog up with the first post. But the trick is, as Mike was suggesting, is you need to be able to sort through that material and figure out how to use it. And there is a certain danger that, you know, some people who, you know, may not have the most, you know,
honorable intentions.
The most honorable right. intentions could be posting things, you know, in a way to manipulate the market. I'll give you one example. This is not something that was done. Well, it's hard to tell what the motivation of what was done, but there was an instance just a few weeks ago where there was a post on not just any blog, but the
Engadget.
Most read blog. Yes, Engadget, which is the most read blog on the internet.
Yeah, that was tough.
Yeah, so the, you know, just to fill in your listeners, the that was a situation where the guy who was writing the blog got a tip from someone at Apple that someone had that they'd gotten an email inside Apple that said that the iPhone was going to be delayed and that so was Leopard, the new version of the Mac operating system. He knew the source. This was someone at Apple that he deals with, and so he did a blog post on Engadget that said, new delays in place for, you know, the iPhone and for Leopard, and the stock relatively quickly lost several billion dollars in market valuation.
Yeah, but you know what the error of that was? From all my, I'd done a little research on this. My understanding was, in his haste to get the post out and to really to be the you know, the scoop, if you will, on this, he didn't verify it.
Well, he did. You know, I've actually talked to the guy who wrote the post, and he did call Apple, but you know, it took some time to get a response back. And in the interim, you know, you have a difficult moment as a journalist or a blogger, which is, well, you know, how much do I trust what I have here, and how much at risk am I to getting scooped by someone else? So he made the decision that, you know, that his source was trustworthy, and he went with the story. And, of course, the stock moved, and then pretty quickly Apple responded to him and told him, no, that this was not true. And somehow, unusual circumstance, someone got themselves access to the Apple email system and was able to spam basically, you know, Apple's employees, and then got this news out there, which was, of course, not accurate. It was not entirely clear what were the motivations of that person. But it just shows you that, you know, there are ways for the creative stock manipulator to use blogs, even blogs that aren't theirs, to manipulate the market.
Well, I find that interesting because we'll see what the fallout. There will be some fallout from this, I do think. I'm not sure what it will be, but whether it's going to be that people are more careful when they say things, particularly when they have such an open platform as they do to say things. And it's a great blog. Don't get me wrong. I mean, yeah, just wonderful.
I would agree. It's well written. It's incredibly comprehensive. They've got about a dozen people working on a single blog.
No, it's good stuff. It's not that, you know, some people, when they think of the word blog, they think of, you know, a one guy in a room somewhere kind of typing away. I don't think, you know, blog has a much broader meaning these days. It's much more of an instant access availability. So, but we're going to finish here so we don't run over the time that I usually try to do. We're a little bit over, actually, but I want to thank you both. And hopefully what I'm going to do right now is put some of the information on what we've talked about and how to read your various blogs and about both of you on the show notes so that people can get to it. And I want to thank you both for, you know, coming on today and sharing some wisdom. And hopefully we helped out those listeners out there with some questions about not only trading but technology. So thanks so much.
The information information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.
Hey, thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'll be here next time. Keep the emails coming in and be sure to subscribe.